It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A Wisconsin chef will help us prepare a Friday night fish fry from our own kitchen with all the sides. First, a new book looks at the long history of medical quackery in the United States and says in many ways, dubious, ineffective, dangerous, and sometimes fraudulent cures are more popular than ever. In the 1920s, John Brinkley told men that they could increase their sexual prowess with a simple $750 surgery, sewing goat testicles to their own nether regions. In the 1950s, a preacher named Charlie Shedd told his followers to pray their weight away. In his new book, our next guest follows modern-day providers of laser treatments, ingested cleaning solutions, pH rebalancing, and other practices that claim to offer the one true cure to everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history and present of dubious medical cures? Are there old remedies and cures you look back on and realize they didn't do much good? Why do you think that often fringe medical ideas gain popularity here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling is a journalist and author. His latest book is called If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. Very, very excited to talk with you today.
Matt, you write in your book that this is not the book you set out to write. What led you down this particular path?
I was writing this book during the early stages and kind of into the peak of the pandemic. And so I thought there were a lot of really interesting public health policy questions being raised right around then. There were questions about government overreach and the extent to which society ought to go to protect the whole from the individuals. And those debates, you'll remember, I'm sure, were really taking center stage as people discussed things like vaccine mandates and workplace mandates for masks and all of that. So I started to reach out to folks who had come into butted heads with the official policies in some way, shape, or form. And I hope to have a really nuanced discussion with them about, you know, where we ought to draw the line when we weigh the rights of the individual versus the rights of society to restrict their movements. And when I started to ask some questions about that, what I found instead was that the folks on the fringes of the alternative medicine movement were so had been so radicalized by their life journeys that they didn't really have a lot of nuanced opinion. Their solution was abolish the FDA, abolish the CDC, prevent any government interference whatsoever. And so then my book kind of shifted into who these folks were and how they had become radicalized over the last 20 years. And that really proved to be a very interesting and rewarding journey to go through myself and to take the reader on.
You met people who invented the cure for everything, whether it was lasers or pH balancing, other things. And there's an interesting turning point in their histories for so many of them. They were kind of lone voices in the wilderness selling what they could, when and where they could. And then here comes the internet. How did that change things for the people you followed and the wider fringe of medicine?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, each of them had stumbled upon something that they thought was the one true cure for all disease, right? And medical science tells us that different diseases and medical conditions have discrete causes and therefore discrete cures and treatments. But they were kind of operating on these separate theories of health that they each believe would kind of revolutionize the way we think about medicine in the country today. And so that was what they had in common. Other than that, they had very diverse backgrounds. And before the proliferation of the internet, the only way for them to get their word out to the public was really to go through like the gatekeepers of medical knowledge, whether that was mainstream media or academic medical journals or university programs, things like that. And none of those institutions would give these folks the time of day, right? And so they were very marginalized. But once the internet allowed folks to reach out to the public more directly, then suddenly those gatekeepers were no longer an effective check on their power to go out and fly their wares to you know, either consumers or victims, depending on how you look at it. And so that was one major change in the country that brought us to our current state. Another change was that in the 90s, there was the passage of a federal bill that's referred to as the DSHEA, the DSHEA, that made it much easier for folks to market supplements and other products without having to prove their health and safety and efficacy before getting them onto shelves. And then the final third kind of magic ingredient in all of this was an active effort by the health freedom lobby to go out and court alternative medical practitioners and to tell them that they should reframe the debate away from whether or not their cures were scientifically defensible, and instead that it should be more about the American consumer's right to choose the medical procedure that they wanted, regardless of that procedure's safety and efficacy. And all those things kind of combined to make a real cluster quack.
Talking to Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling, his new book is called If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. You know, this I'm 66, but it reminds me of the old Westerns when the guy came into town with his wagon and his special concoction and drink this. And I know for me in the 70s and 80s, friends were, you know, wear this copper bracelet or a magnet or drink this concoction. You know, there was always something, you know, and of course now with the whole COVID thing, my God, some of the crazy stuff that, but it seems like this has been going on for a long time.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. And Matt, you write in your book, there is a long tradition here, but it seems to have gotten supercharged, as we were talking about, with the internet and, as Randy mentions, with COVID.
Yeah, Randy's absolutely correct. And there's not a time in American history where there weren't folks out there trying to sell their snake oil and false treatments. And in fact, in the book, one of the topics I touch on is in the 1830s, when a medical freedom movement unfolded that has a lot of parallels to the one that we're in today, in that under the banner of medical freedom, many different healers with many different theories of healing came together and lobbied legislatures to make things easier for the public to buy their services and wares. And they were so effective at that time that they successfully overturned every medical licensing law in the country, so that legally there was no distinction between your university-trained medical doctor and your, you know, say, person who wanted to treat people with leeches. And so now I think today those elements are kind of in place again. And if they were to get what they wanted, that would be the same situation we would find ourselves in today.
I want to, thanks for that call, Randy. I want to meet at least one or two of the people you profile in the book. Let's start with the lasers I mentioned and a dentist turned, I guess, inventor, Larry Little, if I'm saying his name right.
Larry Lytle.
Lytle,
yes.
Okay.
He's a prime example of kind of the life journeys that these folks went on. He was a high school basketball star, a successful dentist, a civic leader in his community in South Dakota, and was really in many ways kind of like an upstanding heroic presence in his community. But then he struck upon this idea that he could harness a universal healing light in his handheld laser devices, and that those devices would allow this light to cure every disease known to man. And he sold these things for like, you know, $12,000, and they had a little remote control, like a television remote control, where you could program in a 3-digit code and wave this device over your kidney, say, and clear out your kidneys, supposedly. And Larry, Dr. Lytle, he was a licensed dentist. He became so convinced of this treatment success that he went out and began selling these lasers for as much as $12,000 a piece, made millions of dollars, mostly selling them to sick and desperate people. And then even when he butted heads with the government, he refused to kind of adjust his path and abandon this idea. His latest chapter of his life is pretty tragic in that, you know, he was eventually arrested and sent to prison while in his 80s. And so this is one of the ironic things is that these stories have a lot of negative consequences, not only for the folks who buy the products, but for the sellers of them as well.
And briefly, with the FDA enforcement process, the FDA doesn't show up and arrest you right away for selling a fraudulent product. There's like, they literally go on for years saying, please stop selling this. Please stop claiming these benefits, right? This is like an incredibly long process that the people you go through in the book run into when they bump heads with the FDA.
Years and years. And this is one of the lessons that I learned while researching this is that we as a society don't really have a great answer to this one true curism. Like the FDA and other federal authorities and state and local authorities, they'll send you the warning letters. They'll come and do an inspection at your facility and send you, you know, items for correction. And as you say, it goes on for years and years before it enters any sort of criminal justice phase. And then the criminal justice phase is often years and years more. And all the while, the more stubborn of the one true curists, as I call them, just continue to sell their wares or maybe making some sort of token effort toward compliance. By the time they're really enforced against in a very harsh way, their personalities are so consumed, you know, their self-identity is that they are a healer with a revolutionary medical idea that they're being persecuted for. And they're so, and plus they're making, you know, in some cases, millions of dollars from these products. And so even when they go to prison, they tend to not show remorse. There was a fellow that I spoke to who was in a Colombian prison awaiting extradition. And he told me that he had, while in jail, treated, you know, 20 or 30 of the other inmates in this facility while awaiting criminal to face his criminal charges for doing that same thing. So it's very, very difficult for us to wrangle with this problem as a society. We really have to go upstream and nip it in the bud somehow.
Talking to Matt Hungel-Tetling about his new book, If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about some of the fringe remedies that he's been writing about, maybe that you've encountered in your personal life or hearing about it from others? Why do you think things on the fringe are popular? How about the middle ground? Maybe it's not something you'd encounter in a doctor's office, but it's sold on that supplement shelf. Call 800-642-1234. We'll hear more of your thoughts coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Matt Hungel-Tetling about his new book. It's called If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to say a happy Easter to you and all your listeners. So my question for your guest is, I take echinacea from time to time. I'll take St. John's wort, occasionally melatonin. And on a lot of these products on the side of the bottle, it says that these claims have not been evaluated by the FDA, yet these products have been sold for quite a long time. And they've been, I mean, these are prescriptions or remedies that have been prescribed in the past, going back to ancient China, thousands of years in India. I mean, it's in the Ayurvedic medicine. So I feel like the fact that some of these things have been around for so long, even though they haven't been evaluated, that there's still some sort of efficacy and value to it.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. And Matt, when you're writing about fringe, I think You're definitely talking about things way fringier than the supplements Marcus is talking about. And also that statement he mentioned on the label, it might say supports immune system health or something, asterisk, not evaluated by the FDA. That's okay under the law. Could you talk about Marcus's comments?
Yeah, Marcus, I'm definitely not on the attack against anyone who takes any sort of supplement. If I was, I think I'd be criticizing virtually the entire country. But I will tell you that you as a consumer are left with a higher burden of responsibility for those supplements that you go out and you purchase from someone who's making money off of that product and who's operating under the same business model that other folks are without some of the oversight and regulations that you would see in other industries. And so, for example, some of the folks that I talked to who are in the supplements industry, they sold what they thought were perfectly good remedies in good faith to their customers. But then they would find out that somewhere back along the supply chain, someone was lying to them. And in fact, some of the herbal supplements can have the ones that are intended to produce more eye-popping effects actually contain illegal amounts of the very same pharmaceuticals that someone who's favoring an all-natural approach might be trying to avoid. And so I urge you, Marcus, to please learn what you can about the supply chain of that. And then just to respond to the other point really quickly, the fact of a long-standing tradition around a particular effect is the sort of thing that typically generates scientific interest and study of a possible remedy. And if it meets those standards and tests, they're typically incorporated into the practices of best evidence. And if they're not, then they're not. And sometimes the fact that something's been used for a long time is less of a selling point than you might imagine.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. Something I want to bring up before we run out of time here, Matt, it would be easy to write a book like this in kind of a mocking tone toward these practitioners and the people who buy things. I feel like you really don't do that in the book. You're very sympathetic. I want to focus in on the people who might buy these products to people who feel like our medical system has let them down, unequal access, expensive care, people not being listened to. You are sympathetic, I think, to people's desire to believe that there's a one true cure out there.
Yeah. I think all of us humans are fairly silly in our own way. We all have flaws of reason. So I certainly see pieces of myself in these folks who have stumbled down these very wrong life paths. And I think that is how we ought to think of them rather than as real enemies of the public health. The fact is that they're in some ways victims of their own delusions. And the real problem is that this has bred, immense distrust of the whole medical scientific establishment, in part because that establishment is very flawed. Certainly medical science has some skeletons in its closet and a bad track record in some ways. But at the end of the day, it's the best tool we have for measuring whether or not a procedure or a practice is effective. It's responsible for having extended human life expectancy dramatically over the last 100 years. And, it's a shame that faith in these institutions is declining so rapidly. 20 years ago, vaccines were more popular, according to public surveys, than Dolly Parton, if you can believe that. But today, we have hundreds of millions of Americans who distrust medical science in general, and tens of millions of Americans who, during this most recent pandemic, had been led to believe that the establishment was so corrupt that vaccines were worthless. And that costs, of course, many people their lives.
Time for one more caller. Victoria is with us in Whitewater. Victoria, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Victoria?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I wanted to know. I have a cousin who's constantly calling me and asking me to research this product or that product. And many times they are Oprah Winfrey endorsed products, such as her weight loss gummies. And what does he, you know, I usually tell her if it really worked, everybody would be using them. But is that really true? Because if it takes a long time for the FDA to approve things, how?
Yeah, I think your cousin has the right instinct in that she's reaching out to someone looking for advice, and you are that trusted source for her. And so I think, you know, all you can do is try to turn to the folks that you trust in who have perhaps, you know, more of a professional skill in evaluating these sorts of medical claims. And yeah, I think when I see a media personality like Oprah Winfrey, like Alex Jones, selling products and making millions of dollars without seemingly a high degree of regard for the efficacy of those products, I think it's really sad, you know, and I think we need a system that doesn't create such a financial incentive to do this. You know, what one thing that I found in the study is that there's a higher risk reward benefit to selling illegal pharmaceuticals than there is to selling cocaine. You know, it's like 32 times more profitable to sell a pharmaceutical drug illegally than it is cocaine. And so, of course, bad actors are going to come out of the woodwork and take advantage of all that free space and free reign that they've been given.
Victoria, thanks for the call. And Matt, thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling, journalist and author. His new book is If It Sounds Like a Quack, A Journey to the Fringes of American Medicine. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we're going to try making some fish fry at home. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Senate voted to end the use of force authorization that opened the door for the Iraq War in 2002. We'll find out how the law has been used over the last two decades and what, if anything, it would mean if it ends up actually being repealed. Now, like brats, cheese, and beer, the Friday night fish fry is a big Wisconsin food tradition, especially this time of year. Supper clubs will soon be filling up today with eager patrons sipping old fashions and hungry for some fish, potatoes, a little coleslaw, a side of tartar sauce, maybe some bread and butter. For this Good Friday edition of Food Friday, we're helping you recreate the fish fry experience in your own kitchen. Our guide is a classically trained chef, a 2020 James Beard Award semifinalist, and Madison Magazine's 2023 Chef of the Year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make fish fry at home? Want to hear you tell us about it, how it works for you. And if you have a favorite place to go for fish fry, past or present, we want to hear about it. You can name names, a supper club, a restaurant, a church basement. Share your favorite fish fry. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean Farr is the owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison and the Muska Lounge in Monona. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are expanding next door to that restaurant in Monona. I understand the menu of the new place is going to include some fish fry. As a restaurant chef, how do you approach the fish fry, this thing that's really popular here in Wisconsin and a lot of people are going to have opinions on?
Well, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when I opened up Mint Mark, I knew that fish fry was such an important part of the culture in Wisconsin, having grown up here, that I knew that I would be missing out on customers and Friday night business if I didn't throw my hat in the ring. So I take fish fry very seriously. And really, for a number of years, the team and I pushed so hard to try and create the best fish fry we possibly could in Madison. And I think we did a really great job.
What, you don't need to tell me your secrets exactly, but what is it that makes the fish in particular good when you're serving it up?
Well, the fish, for one, needs to come from within an area that's touching the state, I believe, you know, somewhere from the Great Lakes. So all of those little fish like the bluegill, the perch, those are the prime fish to look for. Atlantic cod is great. It's a great fish fry option. But at the end of the day, lake fish, I really feel, are the way to hit, especially walleye, too. That's a great one. But the secret, the secret is really within the batter. You want something that's going to hold up and stay crispy and have that, you know, that super crunch when you bite into it, all at the same time, not obscuring the subtleties of the white flaky fish that our Great Lakes provide.
Now, not everybody's going to try to make the fish itself at home, but if we do want to, kind of, what's the bare minimum level of equipment we need?
Well, I, for one, would never try to do it inside because your house is going to smell like I do when I come home from work on Friday. So when I get tasked with this about once a year at my in-laws' cottage, typically, you know, somebody has given them a mess of perch or bluegill, even some walleye, maybe some pike once in a while. And it's up to me to fry for 15 to 20 people. I set up a turkey fryer with a shallow pot, or like what we call a rondo in the restaurant industry. And I fill that up with fryer oil, your canola oil, and I try to fry outside. I certainly, one of the things that I think we do really well at Mintmark, and we'll be doing really well at Hank's, our new fish fry and burger joint, is the crispy batter. It's got to be light. It can't be weighted down with flour. So the way I go about that is I tend to think of it as more of a tempura, but instead of water, using beer, and using rice flour instead of AP flour. So that within its own kind of sets you up for success. It's how far you want to go with seasoning, sometimes garlic powder, onion powder, what kind of beer you want to use. I prefer hams or something cheap and pungent, so it carries through. But really, if you set yourself up outside and get your fryer set to about 350 degrees, and make a batter that you feel isn't like super cakey and thick, I think you're already winning.
I think the biggest mistake I make when I batter fry things is I'm not known for being a real patient guy, and I want to get stuff into the oil, and I do it before it's heated to that consistent temperature. I know what happens. What happens then when we don't have hot enough batter?
Well, that, and you know, you're going super French at that point with your low temperature and your confiting, which is, you know, reserved for duck legs and pork bellies and that sort of thing.
You
got to get
it
hot,
man,
and fast.
Okay. And now spicing in the batter. Now I worry, like, okay, yeah, you're going to taste salt and pepper and stuff like that. If I'm getting all subtle with spices, oh, but it's getting deep fried, am I just like burning those spices out of the picture? Am I wasting my time and money putting those in?
No, I really don't believe so. I mean, we use a certain amount of garlic powder and onion powder in our batter. We also, you know, put a certain amount of salt. I think the salt actually, although very important to have in the batter so everything kind of tastes seasoned throughout, really shows up mostly on the outside, kind of like a French fry as well. But I don't think it's super lost. At the same time, you don't want to get wild and start throwing like caraway or, you know, like allspice in there and getting weird. I mean, we're in Wisconsin. We got to keep it real, you know?
Talking to Sean Farr, owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison, the Muska Lounge in Monona, soon to be Hank's in Monona as well. Talking about fish fry, making fish fry at home and or the side dishes at home. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried making fish fry at home? What is the secret to a good fish fry, whether it's at home or at a restaurant? Do you have a favorite place to go for fish fry in your community? And are you going somewhere tonight? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, Sean, we got the fish. We got to have something to dip it in. You say you're a big fan of making our own tartar sauce at home. What goes into that?
Correct. We chose the restaurant, we make everything from scratch. That's a bit of a daunting task for somebody to take on at home. You know, cutting your own French fries, blanching them, and then frying them a second time. Shredding your own cabbage. So, you know, I suggest buying, you know, the frozen French fries, maybe some coleslaw dressing to make your own like the coleslaw that way. But the tartar sauce, at the end of the day, the tartar sauce is what that fish goes into. And it's the thing you're always like, hey, excuse me, can I get another side of tartar sauce? So for me, it's important to keep it light because the idea of dipping something in straight mayonnaise can sound a little gross sometimes. So the way we do that is through acid and fresh herbs. At Mint Mark, we use a ton of lemon juice and lemon zest. We use chives, tarragon, parsley, and much to fishfryguy.com's chagrin, we use fresh dill in there as well, and capers and shallots and pickles. So all of those things get mixed up and chopped up really hard and folded into mayonnaise. And with all that herbage and lemon juice, it becomes really light and really savory and really just a great like palate cleanser on the tongue, which nobody really says about tartar sauce, but I would put that on anything.
Okay, the thing that baffled me out of all that is somebody's complaining about dill in their tartar sauce. Like, I think dill is good with fish, right? Dill's good with lemon. What? Who?
I
What?
mean,
Why?
you know, science has shown that dill goes well with fish.
Yeah, okay. I don't understand what that complaint would be. Now, when you do that thing for your in-laws, and you're doing the fish fry, what is the range of sides you have along with? You got the fish, obviously, you got the tartar sauce. In your home presentation of a fish fry, what do you got to have?
In my home presentation of a fish fry, I like to see the coleslaw. I like to see the French fries. I like to see Aunt Renee's baked beans that she makes with like all the brown sugar and ground beef that goes into it. That seems to be in a crock pot every time we're there. And then at the, you know, more importantly, the biggest ingredient is just having all the friends and family around to help eat it and enjoy it with. I mean, the entire goal of the Wisconsin Fish Fry is to go out and celebrate, you know, like a blue collar sense. You worked all week long and you get finally get to go to the supper club or the tavern. You know, if it were up to me, I'd go to Chico's Villa Tap, and you get that first old fashioned and maybe the second one, and you wait for your table and you catch up with people over the week and you finally get to relax. So I think at the end of the day, the most important side is the company you keep and the fish fry that you eat.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jacob is with us in Burlington. Jacob, hi.
Hi. We recently got into air frying, and I love doing seasoned fish in the air fryer and things, but getting breading on in the air fryer, I'm not having a whole lot of luck either getting it very brown or getting it to stick to the fish. And you know, they recommend flipping it halfway through the air fry. Does your guest have any experience with that or recommendations?
Huh. Can it be done, do you think, Sean, getting the batter to stay on the fish in the air fryer?
I don't believe a fish fry with a wet batter can be achieved in an air fryer. However, I do know that if you have taken fish fry home from wherever you've eaten it in a to-go container, the next day it does refresh really well in an air fryer. But unfortunately, wet batters, such as a beer batter for a fish fry, need to be completely submerged in oil to kind of help encapsulate it around the fish.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Nina joins us now in Menasha. Nina, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a comment that when we come up to Wisconsin on vacation, we don't have fish fries in Arizona, but I love, used to love to go to the VFW. They made the best, and I love the elderly veterans and their wives and stuff that used to work there. It's closed down here now. But one other thing I wanted to comment, the chef that's on now is, I had worked in a restaurant, and I'm just curious to, you know, we need to have some kind of, I don't know, regulation, because I went out for fish fry recently and I got served tilapia and they were trying to tell me it's haddock.
Uh-oh. Nina, thanks for the call. All right, to her first point, Sean, you were talking about the company and, you know, the tradition of, you know, supper clubs and restaurants, of course, but like VFWs and church basements during Lent, that is another great part of the fish fry tradition.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the best fish fries I've had were from my hometown in New London, Wisconsin, from the VFW. Once in a while, the Catholic Church would put one on. And, you know, and there was a campground where, you know, it was all elderly ladies that were doing the fish fry. And I'll be darned, they're some of the best that I've ever had and some of the most memorable fish fries for sure.
And then Nina brought up her concerns about fraudulent fish in the fish fry. Have you ever run into that anywhere?
There are there's some people out there that, you know, that just aren't ethical when it comes to what they're serving. But, you know, I think the places that really hold this tradition near and dear to their heart and want to celebrate it wouldn't be doing something like that. But I have certainly heard of those types of things in the past.
Nina, thanks a lot for that call and for visiting us from Arizona. We're talking to Sean Farr on this edition of Food Friday. Sean's the owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison and the Muska Lounge in Monona. He's our guest for this edition of Food Friday. He's helping us recreate the Friday night fish fry from home, whether we're making our own fish or just the sides along the way, and his love of the fish fry tradition in Wisconsin, even if, as most of us do, we go elsewhere to eat it. Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a secret to a great fried fish, a great coleslaw, good potatoes to go with fish? Let us know at 800-642-1234 and tell us your favorite place to go out to for a good fish fry. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Sean Farr, owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison and the Muska Lounge in Monona. He's helping us create a Friday night fish fry in our own kitchen and some appreciation tips when we go out for fish fry as well. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what goes into making good fish for fish fry or all the sides or a secret of your own you want to share or a favorite place to go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Matt is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Matt.
Hey, great show. I always love talking about food.
Me too.
Favorite place in Green Bay is Merrick's Bar. They've been around for 100 years, it seems. They've just got always a consistent, standard, very lightly battered or breaded type of fish. The second comment is I've got a recipe for the easiest tartar sauce in the universe.
All right.
Basically, it boils down to mayonnaise as the base, and then pickle relish, but you need to get like the Heinz dill pickle relish. A few tablespoons of that in the sauce with some onion powder, and you've got the most amazing and simple tartar sauce to make.
Matt, thanks for the call. What do you think of that quick tartar sauce hack, Sean?
I mean, it's got the dill in it, right? Mm-hmm. You can't go wrong.
Exactly. Matt, thanks a lot for sharing it. Now, and he mentioned in Green Bay that's 100-plus-year-old tavern serving the fish fry. And that's pretty cool that we have places in Wisconsin that have been at this for decades. You're hoping, I imagine, to replicate some of that experience, Sean.
Absolutely. I mean, if I could have an establishment for 100 years, that would be absolutely amazing.
Matt, thanks for the call. Jim joins us now in Green Bay. Jim, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I have a similar story, but I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and the Lake Erie perch and walleye is pretty famous. And we would go out, catch a couple hundred perch, bring them in, fillet them, and then my mom would cook them up. She would use a egg wash and then coat them in saltine cracker crumbs, mm-hmm. and then fry them up. And it was a very she would grind them up like powder.
The saltines.
And it was a very light batter. And it had a little salt in it already from the saltines. And it was, we would sit there and just eat till we passed out. with all the, and that was in the day when there were no limits. And we caught them and we, you know, eat, fry them up fresh and go back out the next weekend.
Jim,
we also had
gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. I appreciate sharing that experience. That's about as fresh as fish is going to get, Sean. And your rule of the fish in your restaurant, your fish has to come from at least a state adjacent to Wisconsin and no further. Is that in part to get that fresh fish experience?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of what we deal with in the fish fry world is what we call IQF, or individually quick frozen, as well. there's no way I could pay for people to break down perch or bluegill all day long. I'm going to actually assume it was a Jim. His family might be a great person to hire or a great team to hire to do that. But yeah, I always try and make sure it's coming from, you know, as local as possible, just so it's, you know, it's not sitting in some freezer across the pond and then, you know, getting shipped over and thawing and then getting frozen again. You want to try and serve the highest quality product you possibly can.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that experience, and welcome to Wisconsin. I don't know how long you've been here from Cleveland. Talking to Sean Farr on Food Friday, head chef and owner of Mint Mark in Madison, Muska Lounge in Monona. Talking about the Friday fish fry, it's still time for you to join in if you call quick at 800-642-1234. We heard from Linda in Milwaukee, Sean. She couldn't stay on the line, but she wants to know about pan frying fish. Any advice on pan frying fish if we don't want to, you know, go to the effort of, you know, full on oil frying that fish?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an option. You want to make sure that you have a pan that's, you know, very high sided and it's not full to the brim, because when you do put fish in, you know, the steam gets released or the water gets released from the fish, causing it to boil. So you want to make sure you're using a pretty high sided pan. Keeping the heat, making sure you're checking the temperature with a thermometer, keeping it around 350, 375, and then not overloading the pan, doing, you know, like five pieces at a time and maybe rotating them, you know.
And my fear always, Sean, when I'm doing stuff like pan fry fish, is that I'm going to overcook it. And that's often what I end up doing. So I don't make fish that often. How do I make sure, you know, it's cooked but not overcooked?
That's kind of the tricky part with the pan frying, because you most likely do have to flip it. So, you know, I would try and keep it about 2 minutes aside. A good rule of thumb is the GBD rule. If it's golden brown delicious, you're probably good to go.
Now let's talk potatoes. I don't want to leave those out. What are your favorite way to prepare potatoes to go with our fish fry?
So at Mint Mark, we do Chad Vogel's famous potato salad from a restaurant that has long been gone in Madison. He's my business partner in a lot of these ventures. So we do like a potato salad with a whole grain mustard and apple cider dressing. And then we also do French fries. We hand cut all of our French fries. They get blanched the morning of at about 275 degrees until the potatoes cook through. And then we wait until service. When they get fired off, we fry them at 375 and season them generously with salt. But I honestly feel like the French fry is the king of all the potatoes. I know there's a lot of people out there that like a good baked potato, but for me, it's another vehicle for tartar sauce, right?
Now, a lot of times, you know, especially the church basement stuff, you get all this stuff and then you get the slice of white bread and some butter to go with it, like the little one pat of butter.
Yes.
Do you include some kind of bread when you're serving up a fish fry?
So I've always loved the weird bread side throughout my entire life that came with it. Regardless if it's a Parker House roll, you know, in a little gold foil packet of butter that you kind of have to like hold in your hand until it's tempered. what we do is we get rye bread from Stalzi's Deli and Bakery. And we even go the extra step as to butter it for you.
Wow.
So we don't have to serve the butter chips. So, yeah, we take that extra step and, you know, my fancy restaurant, we spread that butter for you.
Fantastic. Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
That's Sean Farr, owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison, the Muska Lounge in Monona, and in the nearest future, Hank's in Monona. He joined us for Food Friday with advice on creating a great fish fry at home and the sides along with it, the tartar sauce, and great places to get some fish fry. You can keep informing us over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. What to you has to be included in a fish fry? How do you judge the quality of a fish fry, the fish, the sides, the whole shebang? And where do you like to go, especially this time of year when fish fry is particularly popular? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email us ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If we had a couple few recommendations, maybe I'll share them on the show next week. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, visit Wisconsin medical clinics that offer free or low-cost care to people with limited access to health care. And you can join in as always with your questions, maybe even your own experiences. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. There's a big new number coming to Wisconsin, and if you live in the right part of the state, you could be the first to use it. It's a new area code. According to a release from the Public Service Commission, the 920 area code in northeastern Wisconsin is running out of numbers, and so there's going to be a second area code for that region. The magic number will be 274. It's got a pretty good ring to it. This is called an overlay, so instead of carving out part of 920 into a separate zone, 274 will be used in exactly the same area. Now, if you've already got a 920 number, nothing changes. But if you're getting a new phone number for personal or business use, at some point, they're going to start issuing 274s instead of 920s. If you time it just right, you could get the very first 274 number. And I look forward to seeing the first 274s popping up here on Central Time. Phone news you can use. This is Central Time.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.